Yes, so it's a dark December night. It's a certain time of year, and I don't mean the time of year where I'm looking at my seed catalogues, because it's a sort of more general certain time of year, the sort of time of year where we get, well, the nights are long and we get mince pies for dessert on our retreat. I don't want to mention the date, but some of you will have noticed what the date is today. And what if on a dark December night in the middle of winter in Britain, what if we were to look into Akshobhya's mirror? So last night we were introduced to Akshobhya and his mirror-like wisdom that's like a still lake in which everything is reflected absolutely true with no distortion and no delusion. So what if tonight, of all nights, we were to look into that mirror and perhaps we were to see somebody, a cheerful person who represents perhaps abundance, who has lots to give, who carries precious gifts and wants everybody to have precious gifts. What if we were to see that type of person? What would we think? And what if we were also to see maybe this person who embodies generosity and giving and who only seems to exist, whose sole purpose seems to exist to give? What if they were also accompanied by some kind of four-legged animal prancing through the sky, also carrying precious gifts? What would we think if we looked into Akshobhya's mirror and we saw that? We might think we'd accidentally turned on the TV and we're watching an Argos advert. We might think that we'd fallen asleep by the fire and we're having a childish fantasy about what we might wake up to in the morning. We might not believe what we saw, even though we've been told this mirror-like wisdom reflects only what is true. We'd start to think, well, that's not true. That figure that can bring wealth and gifts to everybody, that doesn't exist. And certainly that flying animal, that wingless mammal. We can't believe, we can no longer believe in this mirror. But what I would like us to do is to suspend our disbelief and just assume that maybe this is true. Maybe Akshobhya's mirror is reflecting something absolutely true and reflecting absolutely perfectly. So let's just keep that in mind. I'm going to change the topic now. I want us to look at the shrine. And the shrine, the main colour of the shrine today is gold, isn't it? Yesterday we had blue, and now it's transformed into a golden, radiant, sort of yellowy, shiny shrine. And it's got gold cloth, a wonderful amount of gold pots, and these shiny beads spilling out of the pots, a sense of overflowing abundance. So I'm going to tell you some stories about gold. So the first story relates perhaps to what we might have been thinking about when I was sharing the mirror-like reflection. The first story is of a saint who lived in Greece at the same time as the Romans. So a Christian saint, an early Christian saint. He was a saint of legend. His name was St. Nicholas. And there are many, many stories about St. Nicholas. He seemed to have been quite a holy person with that mysterious things happened to. The thing that's given him fame throughout the ages is one story where there was a father and he had three daughters and he had no money for their dowries. He had no money for their dowries. So the family were in despair. They didn't know what to do. one night, three nights successively, actually, through the high window of their family home, a bag of gold would fall. And there was one night this happened, a second night this happened, and a third night this happened. And so the family had enough money to pay the daughters' dowries, and the daughters didn't have to go into prostitution, a life of prostitution, which is what would have happened if they hadn't been able to be married off. And somehow this magical appearance of gold has been attributed to St. Nicholas. So that's one story about gold. Here's another story about gold. This is a story about someone I knew. It's a true story. So a man I knew, he was a builder. He was a kind of lovable rogue character. And after I haven't seen him for a long time. After I last saw him, I heard a tale of him. And he'd been doing some restoration work in Spain. He'd been working on a very, very old house. And while he'd been working on the old house, he discovered, either under the floor or digging up the foundations or hidden in the wall, he discovered a bag of Spanish gold, a bag of Moorish gold, probably from the time when the Moors were kicked out of Spain. Several hundred years ago. You imagine doing that? It's a sort of fantasy, isn't it? To dig up a trove of gold. How wonderful. That's what I think. How wonderful to find that buried treasure. It fills me with delight to think of that. So what the man did, it wasn't his house. He didn't tell the owners. He took the gold. And he took the gold home. And he told his girlfriend about it. And his girlfriend blackmailed him and said, I want half that gold, otherwise I'm going to tell on you. So he had to split his gold in half. And I don't know what happened to that relationship. Either way... I don't think it went well. They stayed together or split up. So those two stories about two different things you can do with gold. You can give it away to help people, or you can keep it for yourself. I like talking about gold. I think it's very beautiful. Gold has got... Well, it's an element, isn't it? It's got a very, very pure, pure associations. It's dug up from the ground, and when it's been worked on, it's extremely beautiful. It's warm. It's this warm colour. It's got a beautiful lustre, and it has all sorts of associations. Gold. It radiates this warm light. It can be associated with sunlight. It can be associated with sovereignty. So it's sort of a kingly... there's a kingly quality to gold, isn't there? The regalia of state is often in gold. Especially old gold. I don't know if you've ever seen... For example, the British Museum, or the sort of the way that gold sort of preserves its incredible, like it's sort of almost got an inner light. So very old jewellery and crowns and things that you see in museums, they just sort of seem to glow eternally. The British Museum's got some lovely golden items, Anglo-Saxon things, jewellery. And one of my favourites is, it's very, very, so gold can be very strong and heavy, but also can be beaten into leaf. So it can be very fragile as well. And there's in the British Museum, there's a Roman crown, and it's in the shape of oak leaves, so it's like a sort of garland of oak leaves, and there's bees, tiny little bees, and acorns in it as well. It's beautiful. I think it was awarded for winning races and that sort of thing. I think it was an athletic, I might be wrong, but I think there's some sort of athletic award, that golden crown. You can see it in the British Museum. So there's associations with sovereignty, perhaps leadership, sunlight, even got ripened corn, ripened corn, barley. Barley in particular is a beautiful golden colour. So for me, the associations are of well-being, of abundance, of richness. Like, you don't need to worry if you've got a lot of this kind of wealth, yeah? People do, though, don't they? They do. Yes. There's other associations of gold away from the actual metal. There's a famous poem by Keats where and I forgot to write down the title because it's quite long. Something like "When I First Encountered Chapman's Homer," something like that. Those of you who know it will remember the title. So in this poem, he describes reading a new translation of Homer. And in this poem, the first two lines are, "Much have I travelled in realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Much have I travelled in realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen." So in this way, Keats is invoking gold, the gold as a mental state. He's talking about his imagination, the realms of gold. He hadn't travelled in realms of gold. He's talking about imaginative journeys he's been on in his poetic life and in his reading and in his literary life. He's describing as realms of gold. Yes, one could go on. Gold is such a symbolic colour and such a symbolic metal. It signifies in many quests, many adventures, many sagas, the search for gold. And the Buddha talked about gold as well. He talked about gold in different ways. One of the ways he talked about gold is that even a rain of gold coins wouldn't satisfy sensual desires. Sensual desires give little satisfaction and much pain. Even a rain of gold coins wouldn't satisfy them. But another way that the Buddha talked about gold was perhaps akin to the way that Keats is talking about it. He talks about the mind in meditation as being like molten gold. This is one of my favourite similes of the Buddha, that the mind of meditation, the meditative mind, is like molten gold. And he says it's like molten gold because it's malleable and it's ductile. So ductile means that it can be drawn into long strands, and that's what you would make. That's the quality you'd look for in jewellery making, is a metal that can be drawn into long strands. And it's malleable. You can make it into things. So gold in this simile becomes, well, first of all, you can imagine molten gold. And I was a bit unimaginative, actually, when I was planning this talk. I looked up gold melting on YouTube as well, which was really enjoyable. And watching someone pouring molten gold into water, and it just sort of spread in all these wonderful shapes. So what the Buddha's saying is that the mind is a very valuable thing, and the mind in meditation can be used so creatively, and so positively, that there's a sense of something very precious happening. And what he meant was that the mind in meditation can be the meditative mind has this warmth and malleability to be susceptible when it's exposed to the Dharma. Yeah, so you can meditate and you can soften your mind, and that might well be very pleasant. You might well get into quite deep meditative states, but it's not going to change you unless you're reflecting on dharmic truth. So this is what the Buddha saw, the value of the molten gold mind, was that it can be used to respond to dharmic truths. So if you find that your mind in meditation has a golden quality, this is a very good sign, because it means that when you reflect on impermanence or the impermanent nature of conditioned existence, or the unsatisfactory, the unrewarding unfulfillability of our lives, if you reflect on those reflections will go much, much deeper than just merely thinking about something. Yeah, so the meditative mind that's like molten gold isn't like thinking about something. It's a much more creative, responsive state of mind. And sometimes in meditation, I haven't exactly felt that my whole mind is molten gold, but I've definitely, in my more blissful moments, felt a golden quality, a kind of sparkling or a brightness to my mind. And the question is, well, that's all very well, but how do we get our minds to be like molten gold in the first place? How do we make our minds more susceptible to the dharmic truths? How can we let our minds relax enough to melt in this way, to keep going on about the melting metaphor? So perhaps this is the time to introduce the figure who we first saw in the reflective mirror-like wisdom of Akshobhya's pool of water. And he's the next figure in the five Buddha mandala, and his name is Ratnasambhava, and he's at the centre of our shrine today. So this is Ratnasambhava, the golden yellow Buddha. Ratnasambhava means, Ratna means jewel, so as in tree Ratna, which means three jewels. Ratnasambhava can either mean jewel born, so born of jewels, or it can mean jewel producing, so almost like birthing jewels. So Ratnasambhava, a beautifully treasure like name. So I think looking at the qualities of Ratnasambhava might help us with this question about how do we make our minds like molten gold. Well, let's have a look at Ratnasambhava. Let's look at his posture. So, like all of the Buddhas in the five Buddha mandala, he's seated, his legs are folded in meditative posture. And then his right hand is reaching down. And rather than touching the earth as Akshobhya was yesterday, his palm is outstretched. And this is called the Varada Mudra. So mudra is the hand gesture, Varada Mudra. And it's known as the gesture of supreme giving, the gesture of supreme giving. So his palm is outstretched in an action of giving. And I sort of, if I do that, I can feel it. If I could do that, it's a sort of, here you go. And he's perpetually doing this. Ratnasambhava is perpetually, here you go. This is for you. The gesture of supreme giving. Giving or generosity in when we use the word, when we use it in Buddhism, we say dana. So sometimes if you go to a Buddhist centre, there'll be a bowl saying dana. It means donation or generosity. So let's look at generosity. It's a fairly ordinary thing, isn't it? Like, we know lots of people who are generous. We've probably all been generous ourselves from time to time. So why is it a quality of a Buddha? Why is generosity a quality of a Buddha? Well, maybe let's look at ordinary generosity to start with. Let's look at ordinary generosity and think of the ways that we could be generous. So we've been talking about gold and riches, so maybe we could just think, well, there's ways to be generous with material possessions, aren't there? There are ways to be generous with material things. You can give gifts. You can discover what somebody wants and you can get it for them. Very, very nice. Very nice to do that. Whether it's something beautiful or something practical that's going to help them in their day-to-day life. I think we've probably all experienced the satisfaction of giving someone something that they appreciate. We can give time. We can just pay someone some attention for a period of time. And I just know what that's like to be given time, to be given people's time. I'm always extremely grateful if someone spends time with me or helps me or listens to me. When that doesn't feel like they're cramming me in, like I'm just another thing to do in their day. Have you had this experience when you're in someone's company and they're just really there for you? Or maybe they're giving practical help as well. One of those, I don't know, you know when you just have to do, you've got a task to do and it's really a bit beyond your capacity and then someone steps in and really helps you. Like, I always think moving house is like that. It's like, you can't do it on your own, can you? It's just, it's too difficult. And then people turn up and they help you. So we could be that person. We could be the person who helps our friend move house or listens to them when they've got a dilemma. Again, you know. We could give kind words. That's not too hard, is it? She says. I find that quite hard, especially giving compliments. It's, all sorts of social anxieties get in the way of a freely expressed compliment sometimes. And I think this is the case with generosity generally, that we can feel this here you go gesture in our hearts, but then lots of things get layered on top, like, oh, that'll be a bit much, or what if they don't like it, or what if that's awkward? So then we sort of keep it unexpressed. So I think that's one thing that we could practice, even just noticing when we don't express our immediate generosity, or immediate generous response. We could notice that and then see if we could try and next time it happens, really just follow it through. And sometimes we don't feel like we've got very much to give. And sometimes we feel like we've got nothing to give. Sometimes it seems like the whole world's got everything, everybody else has got everything that they want, and we just haven't managed to get what we want in life. We haven't figured it out. For everyone else, it's working. And there's something that we need. Do you ever get this? There's something that we need, something that I need, that everybody else has got, and I don't even know what it is. Yeah, so it's sort of an attitude of emptiness or lack. And it might be monetary. It might be that all our friends are literally richer than us, and we haven't. We're struggling to make ends meet. yeah. I struggle with that too, but so if you find that you haven't got anything to give, well, the first thing to do is notice what you do have. So the pre-generosity practice is appreciation, yeah, and it doesn't take long, even if you don't quite feel it. It doesn't take very long to notice what you do have. Yeah, and if you make a discipline of noticing what you do have, then it starts to build up and become more natural. So you don't notice, you don't practice in appreciation in relation to other people. So you don't go, you don't go, oh yeah, at least I've got, my bedroom's quite nice and I've got nice flatmates. But, and then, so, okay, that's good. But then you think, oh yeah, but my friend, I really want to live on my own and my friend lives on her own and I can't. So you don't do appreciation in like, oh, mine's okay, but it could be better. You just do straightforward, these are the things that I have. So it might be material things. It might be things that people have taught you. So it's quite nice to reflect. I quite like reflecting on the people who've taught me. And I don't just mean Dharma teachers. I mean my primary school teachers. You know, I was just a kid and there I am in their class and they have a passion for passing on and helping children learn. So I'm really appreciative of that. So people, it's a really nice thing to think about, is cultivating appreciation for people who've passed on knowledge. And that's something we can also give. We can be generous with our knowledge. We can share knowledge. Cultivating appreciation requires a little bit of time, a little bit of reflection, but not much. When I'm on this retreat, and I've got jobs to do, but it's very nice just to think, well, if I spend 30 seconds between here and there, looking at the garden and the sky, that gives me a chance to appreciate and just have a broader sense of my context and how lucky I am, actually, how lucky I am. And it doesn't detract from anything, that 30 seconds, or even 15 seconds. You know, it doesn't take very long. So cultivating appreciation requires a little bit of thought, but it doesn't take much. It doesn't take much. And I think it's quite nice that if you're struggling in meditation and you're not motivated, especially in your day-to-day life, maybe you could start warming yourself up with sitting on the cushion just by cultivating that sense of appreciative awareness. And it's a quality that I've noticed in Buddhists who've been practicing for a long time, is just a general sense of easy appreciation, uncomplicated delight in daily things. I remember my friend, someone gave her, she had an evening off work and she wasn't doing anything at the centre, and someone brought in a packet of crisps and she was like, oh, crisps! My evening couldn't have got any better. Her delight was wonderful. So once you start having a sense of appreciation, then you realise that maybe you're not so empty, and maybe you have got things to give, that you do have that this outstretched palm could be effective, and rather than a sense of needing and like crying for help, you can just give. I was in India earlier this year, and the culture of gift giving there is sort of overwhelming and touching. I was travelling around and I met up with my brother, and he knew people a bit more than I did, and so we'd be visiting and they'd always have these presents for us, and I felt ashamed that I'd come empty-handed, but I needn't have, because they're so happy to give. And we would always discuss how touching would bring tears to my eyes. And I remember getting a present from someone who didn't, she didn't have time to meet me, so I never met her, a sister of my brother's friend, so, you know, not a strong connection, really. And she, young woman, and she had a job. So working life in India is very, very hard. If you're lucky to have a job, you stay in your job. You don't have time for long retreats. You don't have time to have holidays. You want to hold on to that job. So she had a very, very hard, difficult office job, and it wasn't suited to her temperament at all. So she was, by all accounts, a very unhappy woman. But she was so sorry that she couldn't meet me. But she really wanted. She met up with my brother, and she really wanted to buy me a present. And she wanted to buy me a bag. And my brother was with her. And you know that there were some really big, kind of really sparkly bags. And he was going, oh, you know, it's not quite her. Maybe, you know, she's travelling. Maybe something smaller. So anyway, I ended up with this gold handbag with a gold chain and like sequins all over it, which I mean, something about the inappropriateness of the present and her heartfelt desire, that combination was just like, it was just too much. It was like overwhelming. I just I just really brought tears to my eyes, and my brother said, yes, yeah, so, well, you know, she's a very unhappy woman, but what she can do is give, and that's her practice. So she's her life is difficult. Life in India is full of constraints, but she's found a way to bring joy to her life, and that's by being generous, which I found pretty salutary. And I still have the handbag. So, what I'm getting at, that giving gives us a feeling of abundance. Yeah. So giving isn't a calculation of whether we can afford to give, an assessment of who has the most, and then we give like that. Giving is an attitude, and the more we do it, the more we feel able to give. The more we do, the more we give, the more we feel able to give. And generosity is always possible. And there's a little phrase, I think it's by Dado Rinpoche, one of our teacher's teachers, a little motto that says, if you don't know what to do, do something for somebody else. And I find it very helpful, because I often don't know what to do, actually. My general state of being is not knowing what to do. And I even discovered I was on a 2-week solitary retreat, and that's prime conditions for me not to know what to do. So I was in the wilds of Scotland in a little cottage, and I just didn't know. I couldn't get into my meditation. I'd been for a walk. There was a cow in the field in the way between. The sky was blue, yeah. And yeah, I had all this energy, I just didn't know what to do with it. And then I remembered it, and I thought, well, how can I do something for somebody else when I'm 10 miles from anybody else? But I'd noticed that the meditation cushions in the cottage had a hole in, and I had a sewing kit, so I sewed them up. And it just set me straight back on track. And I was like, right, I've done that, I'm fine, great, crack on. So, yes, so giving creates a sense of wealth, and holding on to things creates a sense of lack. I think that's pretty well expressed in the fable of the builder friend that I told at the beginning of this talk. That any sense of shared wonder that he might have had was completely crushed and bruised by his instinct to keep things for himself. And it didn't turn out well. Another sense of richness that Ratnasambhava is associated with is of beauty. So he's the Buddha, perhaps, of beauty, and he's also associated with the arts and culture. And these are things that are shared, aren't they? They're not really owned. The arts, culture, beauty are shared things. Especially culture is a collective endeavour, isn't it? Not only is it created by many, many individuals, but it's shared by many, many individuals and passed on in this way. And not only that, but beauty, and especially the arts, and going out in nature, has a refining effect on our minds. So it's not only something that we can give and contribute, but it can, it's something that has a effect of making our improving the quality of our minds, improving our discernment, our appreciation, gives us joy, a sense of pleasure, and can even challenge us. Beauty, especially art, can even challenge us. And perhaps can even help us create, work towards this mind that's malleable. So the wisdom of Ratnasambhava. So when I'm talking about wisdom, I'm talking about a Buddha's wisdom. I'm not talking about collective wisdom. I'm not talking about learned things or learned things even, as good as they are. I'm not talking about the wisdom that comes with old age, as helpful as that is. What I'm talking about is the wisdom of a Buddha. So a Buddha, a Buddha's wisdom, a Buddha's wisdom is the wisdom that has seen through the delusion of a fixed and separate self. It's seen through all of the things, the root cause of whatever holds us back, and has not just seen it with the mind, has not just had a glimmer of a deeper experience, but a Buddha's whole being has been irreversibly transformed into relationship with the true nature of existence. So there's no resistance, there's no defense, there's no dark side to a Buddha. So a Buddha's wisdom is of this nature, unimaginable. So when we're talking about Ratnasambhava's wisdom, it comes from his gesture of supreme giving. And it means that there is no, for Ratnasambhava, there is no distinction between the giver and the receiver. It's not, if I give a present, I'm all pleased because I've given something to you. And I'm still thinking, it's a positive interaction for that to happen. Or if even better, you can give something to me, that's even more positive. But for Ratnasambhava, that there is no distinction between the giver and the receiver. This gesture has become not just a conscious practice, but it's an attitude that cannot, his wisdom cannot but express this generosity. It cannot but give. It is only giving. And it also changes the relationship between the giver, the receiver, and possessions. So, in this interaction where you give me presents, there's the giver, there's the receiver, and there's the possessions. And at some point, those possessions they belong to you, and then they belong to me. But actually, the sense of possessing things is it's mainly just a convention, actually. It's written into the law. It's a social convention. And it's an emotional feeling as well, isn't it? So whether we have laws or not, we have strong emotional attachments to our possessions. What we decide is ours. Sometimes we even decide other people's things are ours. I live with lots of people, and it particularly happens around mugs. When I don't know who you've lived in shared houses or Buddhist communities, it's like we're meant to be going on beyond preferences, but actually that mug's the right shape, the right thickness of china, it hasn't got any chips in, it might be someone else's, but actually suddenly I get quite possessive around it. Oh, yeah. So, not just me. That's not just me. Yes. But what if everything is ours? What if this whole world, this whole existence, everything is part of us? What if we just invert that sense of nothing is ours, or some things are ours and other things not? What if everything is ours? What if that's the case, then there is no yours and mine. There is no possession. There is no possessed. What if this idea of owning things, even ownership of ourselves, what if that can be seen through? What if that's a delusion? And what is it about owning things anyway? So if I have a mug, a favourite mug, what is it that I can actually own? Can I own the colour? Say, for example, it's blue. Do I own blue things? Do I own the colour blue? The things that I like about the mug, can I actually own them? No, I can't. It's ridiculous. Can I even own the idea of mugs? No, there are hundreds of mugs. There are mugs all over the place. Can I own the texture? Can I own this, the solidity of a mug? No, I can't own it. It's got nothing to do with me. So the properties of mugs can't be owned. The properties of anything actually can't be owned. We might think, because it's all sort of contained in an object and passable, aroundable, or fence-offable, that that we can attribute it to one person or another, but it's ridiculous. It's actually ridiculous. But it's a very, very deeply felt thing. And I remember on a meditation retreat, and I heard some people talking about it this morning, I remember a meditation retreat where this happened. I came to my meditation mat and somebody else was sitting on it. Yes. And I don't know at what point that mat, which had nothing to do with, you know, it belonged to the retreat centre and that patch of the shrine room, I don't know at what point that had suddenly become attributed to me, but it certainly was a shock when I found someone else sitting on it, and I don't think I behaved very well either, I'm afraid to say. And in this relation, I was thinking about rainbows. Rainbows are very beautiful things, aren't they? Do you like rainbows? Yeah. And one of the lovely things about rainbows is that nobody can even pretend to own a rainbow. So people can pretend to own vast tracts of the countryside or bits of the ocean even, but nobody can even pretend to own a rainbow. And that's what's so delightful. So the qualities of the rainbow are, they're colourful, they're sort of mysterious, they're fleeting, we don't know when they're going to come, we don't know when they're going to dissolve, and they're nobodies. And because they're nobodies, they're everybody's. So they're absolutely this popular thing. But what if all things were like rainbows? What if all things were fleeting? Well, perhaps they are. Perhaps everything is fleeting. Perhaps things really can't be owned by anybody. And in that way, if we start to have this attitude, then we can enjoy things with as much wonder as we would contemplate a rainbow. If we start to not appropriate the world into things that we want to bring towards us and things that we want to keep away, then everything becomes beautiful in its own unique way. And this is what Ratnasambhava is saying. Ratnasambhava's light, his gaze is like sunlight and it shines on everything. One of the metaphors for practicing the metta bhavana, or metta, is that it's like sun, and the rays of the sun fall on everybody and everything. Whatever they're doing, whatever they've done, whatever type of person, is indiscriminate about it. And this sense of beauty, Ratnasambhava sees it running through all of existence. All of existence. So looking into Ratnasambhava's eyes, we'd only encounter, it would be like gazing into golden, welcoming, loving sunlight, and it's there for everybody. Okay, so coming to the end. Ratnasambhava's realm is called the realm of glory. And in the realm of glory, everything is falling under this sunlight gaze. Everything is seen in the light of positivity and unity. There's a sense of unity. This the true nature of conditioned existence it runs through everybody and everything, and can therefore be appreciated. Ratnasambhava's wisdom is called the wisdom of sameness, wisdom of sameness, or the wisdom of equality. And it's this sense of unity that brings this about, the sense of empathy with everything. That we're all subject to the same conditions. And under this gaze, pride is no longer possible. So this warmth, this positivity and this abundance, what the effect that it has is to eliminate pride. And Ratnasambhava, he doesn't have any weapons to do this. He doesn't have any destroying implements. He does it by just giving. He does it by magically giving and giving and giving to everybody. Everybody is worthy of Ratnasambhava's gifts. So pride is a concern with an over-identification with our status. It's always relating, it's always comparing things. And it's all right to compare things. I know that some people are better at tap dancing than I am, and that's true. But if I take that really personally, which I don't, if I start really identifying in that way, then that becomes a matter of pride. So pride is often seen as, so arrogance, yeah, bigging yourself up. Yeah, so that's one version of pride. And below that, as long as it's true arrogance and not just confidence, below that will be insecurities. But another way that pride manifests is by keeping oneself lowly, by sort of always going, oh, well, I'm not very good at this, and I'm always... So you're identifying yourself in a particular way. So any time... Pride is something that human beings will naturally do all the time until we're enlightened. But it's interesting to notice that it's not just the people who we think of as proud or arrogant. Yeah. But this sense of abundance, it's like it just knocks down a sense of pride because everybody is so welcome. I had the experience today, actually, I've had it a few times on this retreat, of you can get it from working in a team. So some situations, one really wants to excel and prove oneself sometimes. But when you're working in a team and there's an overarching task and everybody's focused on it, maybe at first you're like, oh, I want to be the best this, or I want to be really good at that so that this person thinks I'm really good at it and that would make me feel good. But if you're working hard and there's a lot of effort needed, at some point, you just start disidentifying with yourself and your own concerns. And you're just really happy. And this happened to me today. I was really happy that people are able to do things in a better way than I am, because my concern is the overall situation. Did I express that clearly? Yeah. So I find that working in teams is a really excellent way to just forget about my own self-concern, a way to sort of rub away at pride. In Ratnasambhava's left hand, it looks like a teardrop in this painting. What it is, true to his name, is a jewel. It's a magical jewel, the Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling jewel. So mani is another word for jewel. So carefully nesting in Ratnasambhava's left hand is the wish-fulfilling jewel. And this is like a transcendental version of Aladdin's lamp, or any of those fairy tale objects that grant you three wishes. So the wish-fulfilling jewel of the Chintamani, it gives everybody what they really, really want. It gives everybody what they really, really want. It's like you can ask the jewel for anything and it will give it to you. The wish-fulfilling jewel is there to awaken our minds. So it can... the only thing that people really want, the only thing that's actually going to satisfy for good, is the wisdom and compassion of the enlightened mind. And that's what the wish-fulfilling jewel will give. So this is the ultimate gift, isn't it? This is the ultimate generosity, is to be able to hand on the Dharma, to hand on the practices of the Dharma, to be able to embody the Dharma so that other people can catch it from one. And this is what Ratnasambhava can signify for us. Now, at the beginning, I mentioned a four-legged mammal, wingless mammal, flying through the sky. And I'm disappointed there isn't an image. So Ratnasambhava's, there's an animal associated with him, which is the horse. And in Buddhism, there's a mythical horse called the wind horse. And it's known to... it's sort of like an embodiment of energy. So although Ratnasambhava's sitting there very sedate, this horse is an embodiment of energy and vibrancy and maybe resolve. So it's the vigour of needed to practice. And the wind horse, traditionally, when you see images of it, is carrying the three jewels of Buddhism, so the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, on its back. So if we look into Akshobhya's mirror, on Christmas Eve or sometime like it, and we see a golden figure carrying infinite jewels in a supreme gesture of giving, and this giving is for you and you and you and you, and it's endless. And on his lap, he's carrying a flaming radiant jewel, and nearby we see a flash through the sky of a flying animal carrying the three jewels. We know exactly who it is. It's Ratnasambhava, and he's here for us.